Blog Talk Radio.
Governors can't afford to do without.
As Sarah Palin might put it,
A Republican governor is sort of like a Republican member of Congress, except with actual responsibilities.
That's right.
Right now, the Republican Party's greatest strength is its governors. The GOP rules a large majority of states, 30 of them, and many executives like Christie, Sandoval, McDonnell, and New Mexico's Susana Martinez are overwhelmingly popular, even though their states went from Barack Obama in the last two presidential elections. At generally doleful gatherings of down-and-out Republicans, such as last month's Republican National Committee meeting, the governors are constantly cited as Exhibit A in the argument that there's hope for the party after all. They are a diverse and dynamic bunch, four are non-white and four are women. They are, in all respects, the opposite of the dismally unpopular old white men of House and Senate GOP. If there is a subtext to the governor's criticism, then it is this: quit making us look bad. The question is whether their funds in Congress are listening. Their friends, rather, are listening. Yeah, that was a good article to start off the show with tonight, because
well, it's true. The governors have to work. The Senate is just sits on their hands.
Yeah, but we're right on the precipice. We're right on the cliff again. I mean, these bastards keep putting us on the cliff again, constantly. And
they don't want to work.
Well, they don't want Obama to get anything done.
And they're just the party of no in Washington.
Party of no. They've always been that. They're just continually that. Now, this is something I wanted to read before, as we go on. We do a lot of environmental stuff and so on, but this one really, really made me ill when I saw this. Because, I mean, everybody eats tuna fish. You know, tuna sandwiches are like the major thing, right? And it's like everybody eats tuna in one way or another. They like it. But here we go. 59% of the tuna Americans eat is not tuna.
Where is that from?
It's from the Atlantic. Magazine. And it says, nonprofit ocean protection group Oceana took 1,215 samples of fish from across the United States and genetically tested them in order to bring us the following astonishing facts. 59% of the fish labeled tuna sold at restaurants and grocery stores in the U.S. is not tuna. Sushi restaurants are far more likely to mislabel their fish than grocery stores or any other restaurants. Turns out that grocery stores, mislabeling by retail outlets are, what, number of fish? 18%. Restaurants
in grocery stores, 38% in restaurants, and 74% of sushi venues mislabel it. In Chicago, Austin, New York, and D.C., every single sushi restaurant sampled sold mislabeled tuna. 84% of fish samples labeled white tuna were actually escala, a fish that can cause prolonged, uncontrollable, oily anal leakage.
That's pretty disgusting.
Oh, that's horrible. The only fish more likely to be represented than tuna, more likely to be misrepresented than tuna, was snapper, which was mislabeled 87% of the time and was in actuality any of six different species. If you've ever wondered why the sushi in the displaced case is so affordable, given the dire state of the world's tuna supply, well, now you know. I won't eat sushi anyway, so.
I know, but you know, you eat tuna.
Yeah, but I'm not eating sushi. I'm eating
tuna
in a can.
Tuna. Yeah.
Right off the boat.
Yeah, about 18% of that stuff is.
They didn't say so.
Yeah, they said.
No, that isn't what they said.
Tuna in grocery stores.
Yeah, but they're talking about fresh tuna.
Well, you gotta wonder if the stuff in the can is real.
They didn't test the stuff in the can. They didn't say what they did.
Okay. Well.
To make that clear.
Moral victory for protesters. Let's go on from it. This one really troubled me. But you know, the reason it bothered me so much wasn't that I didn't doubt it, but it was because, like, at least 5 years ago, Dr. Cass Ingram. We had on our show a number of times over the years, wrote a book called that stated cancer was caused by vaccinations.
Yes, right? He was quite sure of that.
He was positive of it. And he wrote this book called Cure for Cancer or something like that.
Yeah.
And he stated that cancer was caused by our vaccinations. And
because of the junk they put in the vaccinations.
The crazy crap that they put in there, you know, the stuff that they make these vaccinations out of. And he was right. According to 60 lab studies now confirm cancer linked to vaccine you probably had as a child. And we're still giving these damn things to kids.
Dr. Maurice Hellermann made astounding revelations in an interview that was cut from the Health Century. The admission that Merck drug company vaccines have been injecting dangerous viruses into people worldwide. Bear in mind that Dr. Hellermann was the developer of Merck's vaccine program. He developed over 36 vaccines, more than any other scientist in history. He was a member of the U.S. National Academy of Science, the Institute of Medicine, the American Academy of Arts and Science, and the American Philosophical Society.
Bastard with the eugenicists. Yeah. I'm going to go to the rest of that article. Hang on a second.
Takes a minute.
3 seconds.
Oh, no, there it is. This is from the Liberty Beacon.
All the good stuff they tend to pull. Let's see.
Okay, I have to go down.
Yeah,
I've already read that paragraph. Okay, Dr. Mercola's comments. I think it's important to remember history when it comes to vaccines, especially in light of current developments. For starters, the HPV vaccine Gardasil, which is being...
Please remember, Mercola is not the guy who Merck... Mercola is an investigator.
Yes.
Excuse me.
Okay. For starters, the HPV vaccine Gardasil, which is being vigorously pushed on unsuspecting young girls and women to theoretically guard against cervical cancer, still has never been proven to actually prevent cancer. On the contrary, evidence suggests that under certain circumstances, the vaccine increases your risk of precancerous lesions by nearly 45%, and an ever-increasing number of girls are being seriously injured by this unnecessary vaccine. As of December 13, 2010, 20,915 adverse reactions had been reported in the United States alone, including 89 deaths, 297 miscarriages or stillbirths, and 370 reports of abnormal pap smears post-vaccination. All this from a vaccine that has only been on the market for 4 years, making matters worse. As of 2009, the U.S. FDA approved Gardasil for use on young boys as well, and the first male death has just been reported in September of last year. A young boy died just 8 days after being vaccinated with Gardasil. So what's going on here? It's possible that vaccines sold by drug makers like Merck are causing the lethal disease. Judging by history, the answer may be yes. Contaminated polio vaccine has been responsible for human cancer. In 2002, the journal Lancet published compelling evidence that contaminated polio vaccine was responsible for up to half of the 55,000 non-Hodgkin's lymphoma cases that were occurring each year. What was it contaminated with? S40, a cancer-causing monkey virus. The puzzle began in 1994 when Dr. Michel Carbonneau, a Loyola University researcher, found the virus SV40, which had never been before detected in humans, in half the human lung tumors he was studying. Since then, 60 different lab studies have confirmed the results, and SV40 has been found in a variety of human cancers, including lung, brain, bone, and lymphatic cancer. At first, no one could fathom how the virus had been transmitted into the human population. But in the censored interview with Dr. Maurice Hellermann above, Hellermann admits Merck's responsibility in unleashing this virus via the polio vaccine, as well as the likelihood that there was an importing and spreading the AIDS virus in the same manner.
Yeah.
Who is Dr. Maurice Hilleman? Now, for those of you who may think Dr. Hilleman was just another crackpot, he passed away in 2005. Think again. He was, and still is, the leading vaccine pioneer in the history of vaccines. He developed more than 36 vaccines, more than any other scientist in history. And he was the developer of Merck's vaccine program.
He was a member of the U.S. National Academy of Science, the Institute of Medicine, the Academy of Arts, and the Sciences, the American Philosophical Society. He received a special Lifetime Achievement Award from the World Health Organization. So all of these organizations, folks, are frauds.
They're all in love with him.
They're all frauds. And when he was chief of the Department of Respiratory Diseases with what now the Walter Reed Army Institute of Research, he discovered the genetic changes that occur with the influenza virus mutates. This guy was a geneticist.
Let's just wait and see.
Known as Shift and Drift. He was also one of the early vaccine pioneers to warn about the possibility that simian viruses might contaminate vaccines. So Dr. Hilleman knew that he was talking about. And in his own words, vaccines have to be considered the bargain basement technology for the 20th century.
Vaccines can cause the very disease they're meant to prevent and worse. For years, researchers suggested that millions of vials of polio vaccine contaminated with SV40 infected individuals between 1953 and 1963 and caused human tumors, and by 1999, molecular evidence of the SV40 infections was showing up in children born after 1982. Some experts now suggest the virus may have remained in the polio vaccine until as late as 1999. Still, the FDA and health authorities turned a blind eye. In addition, just like Gardasil may well increase your risk of cervical cancer rather than reduce it, if the live polio vaccine has also been found to cause polio, and in rare instance, the virus in the vaccine has been known to mutate into a much deadlier version, reported by MSN News in 2009, genetic analysis has proven such mutated viruses have caused at least 7 separate outbreaks in Nigeria. According to the CDC, the last case of wild polio in the U.S., meaning polio caused naturally and not due to the live polio vaccine, occurred in 1979. From 1980 through 1999, there were no wild polio cases in the U.S. Instead, we had 144 cases of vaccine-associated paralytic polio caused by live oral polio vaccine.
Polio outbreaks in Haiti and the Dominican Republic in 2002 were also traced back to strains of oral polio vaccine that mutated back to virulence. And according to a report by Niels Z. Miller, Global Vaccine Institute, the live polio vaccine from the vaccine can remain in your throat for 1 to 2 weeks and in your feces for up to 2 months. So not only is the vaccine recipient at risk, but he or she can potentially spread the disease to others. In 1999, the Advisory Committee on Immunizations Practices recommended that the United States replace the live virus vaccine with an inactivated killed virus vaccine, which is what remains in use today. However, the inactivated polio virus vaccine has not been without its share of serious side effects either.
Retrovirus vaccine contaminated with pig virus. Last year, the U.S. FDA suspended the retrovirus vaccine Rotarix after an independent lab discovered it was contaminated with a substantial amount of DNA from the porcine circovirus. In pigs, this virus causes poor growth, weight loss, weakness, enlarged lymph nodes, skin rashes, breathing difficulty, jaundice, stomach ulcers, and sudden death. As expected, both the FDA and GlaxoSmithKline spokesman stated that the contaminated Rotarix vaccine carried no known human health risks. However, this is easy to say since there are no studies to confirm or deny a link between these viruses and human disease. In the case of polio vaccine, the link between SV40 virus and human cancer wasn't discovered until 40 years later. It is actually surprisingly common for vaccines to contain various animal matter, including foreign animal to tissue containing genetic material. Once the Rotarix contamination was discovered, new technology was used to test 8 infectious attenuated viral vaccines in addition to Retorex, and 2 others contained unexpected viral sequences. I'm not sure what that means. Does that mean diseases?
Yeah.
Number 1, a measles vaccine was found to contain low levels of retrovirus and avian leukosis virus, a virus known to cause cancer in chickens. This despite the fact that vaccine manufacturers have been required to use eggs from leukosis-free stock for over 40 years. Rotatec, Merck's rotavirus vaccine was found to contain a virus similar to simian retrovirus, that's monkey retrovirus, the SV40 virus previously linked to human cancer. Are you willing to bet that they, A, know what they're talking about, and B, are telling the whole truth and nothing but the truth about the potential health dangers of all these vaccines? Yeah.
You got to remember, these vaccines are made by monkey testes,
all kinds of
eggs,
crap.
You know, they test them in eggs, albumin, and that kind of thing. So
who knows?
And I remember, Cass Ingram, Dr. Ingram, said that it's absolutely
criminal.
Criminal. Yeah, it's madness. It's total madness how these vaccines are made and allowed to do, and they don't do anything.
The HPV vaccine now routine for boys as well. So far, very few parents have voluntarily lined up their sons for the HPV vaccine, but that may soon change, as reported by Paging Doctor, whoever that is.
He's that asshole on. He's one of those asshole doctors.
The guy that pushes it.
Yeah, like Snyderman, who said that she gave her daughters all the Gardasil vaccines.
I don't believe her.
She's the medical whore on NBC, and Gupta's the medical guru, on ABC or something or other. These guys are all, paid by the pharmaceutical companies to push their products, and on national news.
Well, anyway, it's reported by Paging Dr. Gupta, the American Academy of Pediatrics 2011 schedule of recommended routine vaccines for children and teens now includes the HPV vaccine for boys 9 to 18 as well. Folks, this is a disaster in the making. I shudder to think about the statistics we'll see in a few years if parents fall for this nonsense.
I think these friggin' doctors living themselves.
I don't know.
Maybe they're not even doctors. They're just paid mouths.
I urge you to consider the risks already revealed in the 4 short years since the Gardasil came on the market. Already there are close to 21,000 reported incidents of adverse effects and deaths, despite the fact that only 2 out of every 10 women in the approved age group have gotten the virus so far.
Yeah.
Added to this fact, in an estimated 90 to 90% of all adverse effects are never reported, and the abnormally large risks of the HPV vaccine compared to other vaccines should give most people reason to pause.
I don't forget that the a-hole that governs Texas. Remember him?
One who ran for president.
He's already forgotten. But he made Gardasil mandatory.
A requirement
for all schoolgirls, in Texas.
That was repealed.
Yeah. No, was it?
Yeah.
Was it really?
I think so.
I don't think so.
I thought they fought against that.
They probably fought against it, but I don't think it's bad. And it turned out that they gave Gardasil
company,
Merck, I guess it was, or whoever made Gardasil, gave him millions of dollars in his campaign for presidential and governor.
Thank God he lost. Although the FDA ultimately dismisses all side effects, including deaths, as being within the norm, even they have stated that In VARs, a higher proportion of Gardasil reports were
syncope fainting.
In VTEs, venous thromboembolic events, compared with other vaccines, thromboembolic events.
And according to the National Vaccine Information Center, the incidence of miscarriage and stillbirth events from Gardasil supersede the same events from all other vaccinations. And according to a recent SaneVax press release on PRLF, there is no doubt the vaccine safety and efficacy has not been thoroughly investigated. And independent investigations on the safety and efficacy of the HPV vaccines, Gardasil and Cervarix, must be conducted before there are more injuries and deaths.
What's most frustrating about this is not a single one of these 21,000 children and young women needed to be harmed or die. Why? There are still outstanding questions about whether HPV is or is not the direct cause of cervical cancer. The FDA knows there are many other cofactors involved with the development of cervical cancer, and as the 2003 acknowledged that most infections by HPV are short-lived and not associated with cervical cancer. The same news release also states that with proper screening, cervical cancer is avoidable and, if caught early, curable. In essence, 3 years before HPV vaccines came upon the scene, they knew that what was needed, if anything, was a simply improved screening method, such as regular pap smear testing for girls and women that are far less risky than getting an HPV shot. Interestingly and disturbingly, routine pap smears have declined, coinciding neatly with the release of HPV vaccine. Between 2007 and 2010, cervical cancer screening test rates declined by nearly 7%, the New York Times reported in December of last year. When you consider that HPV vaccine increases your risk of cancer if you're already infected with certain types of HPV, this is a double whammy of bad news, since rarely, if ever, are girls and women giving HPV pap screenings before they get an HPV shot. It's all madness. Not only is the HPV vaccine is one of the most unnecessary vaccines in the market, it is also the most dangerous. And now they want to unleash it on young boys, and they're trying to get it approved for older women as well.
Oh, my God. Weighing benefits versus risk. Even without a potential contamination scare, there are serious risks to every vaccine. The HPV vaccine is a perfect example. So before vaccinating, you really need to be careful that the benefits will outweigh those risks. In the case of Rotarix, along with Rotatec, a similar vaccine made by Merck, the benefits are very questionable, especially if you live in the United States or other developed countries. Typically, when a child in the United States contacts a rotavirus, and most do in infancy and early childhood, all that is required is lots of rest, good nutrition, and plenty of fluids to prevent dehydration from diarrhea. The infection also provides natural immunity that will protect your child for life. Along with showing little benefit for a disease that is typically entirely treatable with fluids and rest, a recent drug review by the FDA found that Rotarix is associated with an increase in pneumonia-related deaths in children compared to a placebo. So with this particular vaccine, children living in developed countries like the U.S. are potentially taking on serious risk with what appears to be very little benefit, and that was before the contamination was uncovered.
In the case of HPV vaccine, Gardasil and Cervarix, the choice is clear. It is high risk, and potential benefits are unproven. In more than 70% of the cases, HPV clears up on its own within a few weeks and months. In over 90% of the cases, it's gone within 2 years, causing no symptoms of disease. Only about 26% of girls and women aged 14 to 59 have been exposed to any HPV strains at all, and only 2% have been exposed to strains 16 or 18, the two that Gardasil and Cervarix protect against, meaning this vaccine is completely unnecessary because HPV infection really leads to cancer. Women whose partners wore condoms during vaginal intercourse are 70% less likely to become infected with HPV. That's a far greater level of protection than you can get from this vaccine.
For more depth information about HPV vaccines, along with the top 10 reasons why you don't need it, please see this previous article. The moral of the story, do your homework before subjecting your children to any vaccine. A great way to get started is to simply use the search feature at the top of each of my web pages, blah, blah, blah. So, anyway, this is Mercola.com. Please go to that. He's an excellent source. And this was
from the Liberty Beacon.
Yeah. So, man, unbelievable.
It's 8:30. Did you want to...
Yeah, I think we're going to do that. And
play a little music while we find...
Yeah, I wanted to read this one on Rothschild's one.
Well, let's play the music
first.
Well,
yeah, hang on a second.
So we have a little music to play?
Yeah.
Just a minute. He thinks that you'll like. I hope.
Let me help you understand the enemy. And let me assure you that absolutely nothing that I'm going to tell you is exaggerated, is interpolated, or is imagined. Everything I'm going to tell you is documented. And it's a great deal of it is documented on my website, which is healthfreedomusa.org. Let me back up and tell you that I've been watching Codex come toward us for about the last decade. And I've been watching the votes in Congress, which, God help us, is our bastion of support and protection against Codex, and I'll explain why that is. I've been watching the votes to protect our health freedom dwindle until finally in the 109th Congress, without a good deal of activity, we didn't have the votes to protect us. I've been watching Codex accelerate, and I've been watching it expand, and I've been getting more and more troubled. Let me give you a brief rundown of Codex then. After the Second World War, the Nuremberg tribunals were held, in which people who had committed crimes against humanity were judged by the world community in a court run by the United States and Britain, and they were sentenced to terms in prison if they were found guilty of crimes against humanity. One of the people found guilty of crimes against humanity was the president of a huge industrial megalith called IG Farben. IG Farben produced the gas used in the gas chambers, Cyclone B. Okay. They produced the steel for the death camps and the railroad lines. They produced the munitions. They produced chemicals. They produced all kinds of stuff. They produced pharmaceuticals, big, 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 big pharmaceutical company. So the president of IG Farben was convicted of crimes against humanity. Now, he's a sort of artistic fellow and creative. He was the one who was responsible for the slogan that people saw as they entered Auschwitz, usually for the last time, Arbeit macht frei, work brings freedom. Creative sort of fellow. So he was sitting in jail, and he said, well, that didn't work. What else can we do? I've got it. Food. He who controls food controls the world. So when he got out of jail, he went to his UN buddies and he said, have I got an idea for you? If we take over food worldwide, we have power worldwide. And his UN buddies said, cool idea. And so they created a trade commission. That's a very important pair of words, a trade commission called the Codex Alimentarius Commission. It is not a public health commission. It is not a consumer protection commission. It is a trade commission. Trade is about what? Money, business. Trade is about profit. Well, they said in 1962, we're going to work toward total global implementation of Codex Alimentarius on December 31st, 2009. Long term. And they set up a bunch of committees, committees on fish and fishery, fats and oil, fruits and vegetables, ground nuts, nutrition and foods for special dietary uses, and so on. There are currently about 27 Codex committees. There are regional organizations. There are task forces and so on. So it's a huge bureaucratic monstrosity. It's immense. Codex has promulgated well over 4,000 guidelines, standards, and regulations on everything, everything which can legally be put into your mouth, with the exception of pharmaceuticals. They are not part of Codex. Important. Now, Codex standards have no legal weight whatsoever. Zero. So who cares about them? They're just standards. So we're talking about an industry-dominated regulation-setting organization. But if it has no legal standing, who cares, right? Here's the history of Codex Alimentarius before 1962. the Austro-Hungarian Empire said, we need rules by which the courts can rule on cases involving food. So we'll have regulations and rules that the courts will enforce. That's how they get their weight. That was called the Codex Alimentarius, and it was put into place around 1893 and lasted until the end of the Austro-Hungarian Empire and the First World War. So the idea was there in the Germanic tradition. We need rules, lots and lots of rules. We need a lot of rules. Let's have rules for everything to do with food. So it was sort of a natural extension for the German industrialists to say, well, go back to the good old days of Codex Alimentarius, back when we had them in the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Cool. So they started promulgating their rules and regulations, and they were voluntary. They were sort of guidelines. Now, Codex Alimentarius Commission is administered by the World Health Organization, WHO, and the FAO, the Food and Agriculture Organization. They fund Codex, and they run it at the request of the UN. So they're mommy and daddy to Codex Alimentarius. And that's very interesting because they're supposed to be about health and food worldwide. Some conflicts of interest that we'll talk about. So Codex started promulgating regulations and rules. And the way that's done is that the committees work up a rule, a standard, a guideline, a regulation, and then they get it to what's called Step 8, which is the final step in their administrative process, and then it's presented to the Codex Alimentarius Commission for ratification, like the vitamin and mineral guideline was presented to the Codex Alimentarius Commission on July 4th this past summer. It was ratified, it was approved by consensus, and it is now, despite the propaganda that you're going to hear, if you ever hear about it in the media, it is now mandatory upon any member country of the WTO, the World Trade Organization. Well, what in the world do they have to do with it? And the answer is everything. The World Trade Organization, you see, accepted Codex when the World Trade Organization was formed in 1994. Okay? They said, well, how are we going to decide trade disputes around food if we don't have a set of rules? I know, we'll accept the Codex Alimentarius rules. And all the members of the WTO worldwide will, get ready for an Orwellian term, harmonize with our standards, with the Codex standards. Harmonize. I suggest you capitalize the first four letters in your mind. So everybody's supposed to harmonize with Codex. And when they harmonize with Codex, then if they get pulled into the World Trade Organization dispute resolution process, they have a chance of winning. Because, here's the kicker. You ready for this one? If two countries go into the World Trade Organization dispute resolution process, and one of them is Codex compliant, and one of them is not Codex compliant, the one that is Codex compliant automatically wins regardless of the merit of the case. People are using Codex compliance as a weapon in a much bigger economic battle. So, every country in the world is racing to do what? To become Codex compliant. So, in the United States, the situation is, okay, how do we become Codex compliant when we have laws that protect us? And you have to remember that Codex does not serve consumer well-being, does not serve health. It serves what I call the five bigs: big pharma, big chema, big biotechna, big agribiz, and big medica. Little you and little me are not served by Codex in the least. So before we go forward and talk about the rest of what has to happen, let's ask what Codex does. You probably all know about the vitamin and mineral guideline that was ratified on July 4th. You may not know that although it is said that Codex guidelines, regulations, and standards which have been ratified are voluntary. They are not voluntary. That is known as a lie. They are mandatory, but they are not fully mandatory until December 31st, 2009. They're sort of kind of a little bit mandatory now, and they're totally mandatory then. Okay, so what does Codex do? Why do I care enough about Codex to close my practice and stop treating patients who came to me from around the world to help them regain their health and be radiantly well with non-toxic means, which is a very satisfying thing to do. I love it. And it also provided me with an income. That was nice. Why am I concerned enough? Okay, let's talk about the vitamin and mineral guideline first. In 1994, here in the United States, DSHEA, the Dietary Supplements Health and Education Act, was passed, which classifies nutrients and herbs as foods. As foods, you can set no upper limit on them. You cannot set an upper limit on lettuce, lamb, or rutabagas, and similarly, you cannot set an upper limit on vitamin C, echinacea, ginkgo biloba, vitamin D. And access to nutrients is freely given to us. We are allowed to have any nutrients we want because, and this is a very important point, under common law, anything not forbidden is permitted. Codex, on the other hand, is a Napoleonic code law system. Under Napoleonic code, anything not permitted is forbidden. That's called a positive list. So, vitamins and nutrients, minerals. In 1994, we passed DSHEA. Nutrients are foods. We can have as much of them as we want. It's our business. In 1994, Codex, with no notice here in this country whatsoever, declared nutrients, put on your intellectual seatbelts, declared nutrients to be toxins. They're poisons. Dangerous industrial poisons. As poisons, we have to be protected from them. How do you protect somebody from a poison? You use toxicology. You use a science called risk assessment. A quick primer on risk assessment. First, you take the substance that's poisonous and you feed it to animals and you determine the dose that kills 50% of them. That's called the LD50. Okay? And you extrapolate what the LD50 for a human being might be. Then you go down to the other end of the dosage range and you start feeding itty-bitty tiny bits of it to test animals. And you come up with the largest possible dose, the maximum permissible upper limit, that can be fed to an animal before a discernible impact is shown. Okay? No discernible impact. Then you divide that by 100. That's how they do it in risk assessment. And now you've got a safety margin. So you've got 1/100th of the dose that can be given, the largest dose that can be given with no discernible impact. Okay? Nutrients under Codex not only are limited to those nutrients on the positive list, and we anticipate there will be 18 of them, and they do not include CoQ10, glucosamine, chondroitin sulfate. They do include fluoride, which, to my knowledge as a physician, has absolutely no biological benefit whatsoever. But it does make people complacent. Fluoride was first used in the Gulag because it was discovered that prisoners who were fed fluoridated water were complacent, and you could do anything you wanted to them. They were easy to manage. So you have 18 nutrients. You have itty-bitty, teeny-weeny, little-bitty doses that are determined scientifically to have no effect on any human being. Now, in this country, we have a problem. We have DSHEA. We got to get rid of DSHEA in order to harmonize with Codex, that part of Codex anyway. So how do we get rid of DSHEA? We attack it legislatively, of course. And there are five, count them, five bills currently before Congress designed to overturn, gut, invalidate, and otherwise get rid of DSHEA. Because once DSHEA is gone, we can harmonize with the vitamin and mineral guidelines. So what we're talking about is waking up one morning and being very surprised to find that high-potency, therapeutically effective, clinically significant nutrients are now illegal in the way that heroin is illegal. Not available with a prescription, illegal. If these nutrients have any impact on the human body, they are illegal. That's just the vitamin and mineral guideline. Let's talk about milk. We have recombinant bovine growth hormone, and now we can choose milk with it or milk without it, butter with it, butter without it, right? Not under Codex, because under Codex, every dairy cow on the planet must be treated with Monsanto's recombinant bovine growth hormone. Furthermore, under Codex, every animal used for food on the planet, whether it has fins, feet, or feathers, every animal on the planet must be treated with subclinical antibiotics. Must be treated with subclinical antibiotics and must be treated with exogenous growth hormones. Codex requires, mandates that all food be irradiated unless it's eaten locally and raw. All food, including organic food, of course. So is it organic afterwards? Well, of course, the organic standards are incredibly low. The organic standards allow a farmer to use veterinary drugs, including growth hormones, antibiotics, etc., on animals, and then at his whim reclassify them as organic, but farmers are our friends, and they would never do that, right? Right. Codex sets limits for the dangerous industrial chemicals that you can have in your food. And the limits are incredibly high. Go to Codex Alimentarius, do a Google search, and look, you know, there are drop-down menus at the top of the official Codex page. Look at the toxins and the veterinary chemicals and the levels that are set. They are terrifying to me, terrifying. The names of the chemicals that are permitted and the amounts of the chemicals that are permitted are terrifying to me. Why am I terrified? Well, perhaps I'm just a cowardly person. It's possible. Think about this. In 2001, 176 countries, including the United States, got together and they said there are 12 really bad organic chemicals. They're called POPs, persistent organic pollutants. There are a lot of them, but there are 12 that are so bad that nobody could disagree that those 12 POPs had to be banned worldwide. Nine of the 12 worst organic chemicals known are pesticides, not surprisingly, because they kill things. And, of course, we have many processes and enzyme systems that are very much like insects and other pests, so they're not too good for us. But Codex has different ideas. Codex has brought back seven of the nine forbidden POPs that 176 countries banned worldwide. Dieldrin, aldrin, hexachlorobenzene. And the food that is imported from other countries that contains these substances cannot be stopped at our borders, because otherwise it would be, God forbid, a trade violation. That's how Codex works. Codex, according to the World Trade Organization and the Food and Agriculture Organization, joint projections. Now, I didn't make this up. Please, if you unfastened your intellectual seatbelts, put them back on again. If you do the numbers in the WHO FAO projections, the epidemiological projections, they estimate, not I, because what do I know? They estimate, they're the experts, that just the vitamin and mineral guideline alone, when it goes into global implementation on December 31st, 2009, will result in a minimum of 3 billion, that's B, bad, big, billion deaths, 1 billion through simple starvation. Those folks who die are not particularly economically successful from the point of view of the corporations. When you're starving to death, how much good can you do when you, the issue is how much can you buy? Not a lot. Forget them. Ah, but the next 2 billion, they will die from the preventable diseases of undernutrition. Cancer, the single most profitable condition ever known to humankind. Cardiovascular disease, a good second. Diabetes, pretty good producer. And a whole host of other preventable diseases. Who will die? Who knows? Who will live? Probably those people who are wealthy enough and powerful enough to have their own pushers of clean food and nutrients. That's who will live. You and I? Probably not. Our children? Probably not. Our grandchildren? Probably not. So we're talking about food regulations that are, in fact, the legalization of mandated toxicity and undernutrition. It will be illegal if there's a famine in, you know, wherever there's a famine, to ship high nutrient density biscuits to that country, and it will be illegal to distribute them. That's what we're talking about. Codex is big and it's bad, but it's not invulnerable. So the point is that we have to protect ourselves, and I believe that we have to regain global leadership, which we have lost, surrendered, squandered, sold. No? No global
leadership? No, we have.
We have sold. Just joining the World Trade Organization surrendered our sovereignty. Mm-hmm. However, parenthetically, I have a team of constitutional lawyers looking at the following question. Are we members of the WTO? Because if you remember from high school civics, the way you get a treaty to be a real treaty is to have it ratified by a two-thirds majority of the Senate. And the way we got into the WTO was they passed a law allowing Bill Clinton to fast-track us into the WTO.
That's not a treaty. We are not in the WTO.
Now, that's a piece of the battle. We will tell George, but I don't think he's going to be relevant by the time we tell him. So that's a piece of it, but that's not going to save our lives right now, because
I wanted to. I really enjoyed this. I didn't expect to spend so much time with it, but I'm glad.
But she's a good speaker. She's a bit entertaining.
And I have. If you want to go to this, please go to my website, lesteelshow.org, and just you'll see the video right there. It's called Criminalizing Natural Health.
Vitamins and herbs, Nutricide. She's talking about a lot of things that I didn't realize.
We didn't. This goes on for about 40 minutes. I played about 25, but our show is about to end. So I want to thank everybody who joined us. And tomorrow night we will be the same. Maybe I'll even play the rest of this tomorrow night.
Yeah. Union news to talk about.
Yeah,
and the second half of the show, we'll play the rest of it.
Might do this because we do a lot of environmental and health. So
because it's a worthwhile thing for anybody to listen to.
Please do, yeah. And so I want to thank everybody for joining us and wish you a pleasant evening.
And good night, folks. And talk to you tomorrow. Get our music.
Good night, everyone. They don't do Facebook anymore. Look at these fuckers. They don't.
I wonder why.
That's weird. Because they're competing with Facebook.
former Vice President of the United States, please welcome Vice President Al Gore.
Mm-hmm.
And what are you... Well, first of all, let me ask you this question, because there's a rumor, I don't know if this is true or not, that some scientists are trying to figure out a way to block the sun to try to slow down global warming.
Yeah, it's a measure of the feeling of desperation that some of them
feel. Are they really thinking they could do that?
Well, yeah, some of them are seriously proposing, and I think it's completely nuts.
Yes.
You know, you put another kind of pollution, sulfur dioxide, up to orbit the cover the atmosphere. The sky won't be really blue in the way it is now anymore, but it would block out some of the sun's heat so that we wouldn't have to take the difficult steps to stop spewing all this global warming pollution into the atmosphere. And, of course, there are a lot of problems with what they're proposing. It turns out plants need sunlight.
Yes.
It wouldn't stop the acidification of the oceans. And it really should be yet another wake-up call for why we need to stop putting all this pollution up there. We put 90 million tons every day up there, and that's what's drying out the soil, 60% of the country in drought last year. That's what's contributing to the worsening of these fires. And
Thank you.